Hello and welcome to The Reaction podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Tim Shipman, known to all of you, the grand fromage of Brexit, chief political commentator of the Sunday Times, chronicler of the whole Brexit crisis. He's just released the third book in its Brexit quartet called No Way Out from the Backstop to Boris. And we're going to dive straight in, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
So this follows the first two on Brexit, All Out War and Fallout, which were, you know, bestsellers, both released before the Boris era. When did people then think Brexit was almost over? I can't really remember. But and the final instalment is called Out, I think.
That's right.
And that's coming in June.
That's right.
7 years in the making. I'm not going to ask you, why did it take so long? It's so obvious. I mean, so much has happened. But this is an enormous undertaking. Just that, as a journalist, you know, in awe of the commitment, this is a sort of, it's effectively a decade-long project it's going to turn into.
Yeah, I mean, much to the chagrin of my family. I mean, I signed up to write the book, the third book, in 2018, and I guess I thought we'd be signing it off in 2019 or 2020, and it didn't work out like that at all, and had two kids along the way, which slowed things down a little bit. But, you know, the end of this book just kept retreating into the future. But, you know, I interviewed, well, there's 260, 270 odd interviews, 3.3 million words of transcripts. And just to put that in context, when I wrote All Out War, which was the sort of the quick one after the referendum, turned around in 4 months, I think we probably had about 800,000 words of notes for a 240,000 word book, which is quite a thick book. But this time I've had to try and boil it all down. And ultimately, it to give the level of sort of granularity and fun that people are used to reading in the Sunday Times or in the first two books, you know, we're covering 6-7 years here. The first book was probably sort of meatily about 5 months. The second one was kind of 15 months. But the vast majority of it was on the 2017 general election. And, you know, we're now covering, you know, what would have been a sort of 1500 page book across sort of 6 or 7 years. So the first book picks up where the second one left off, which is with Theresa May signing the joint report, which is the thing that created the Northern Ireland backstop. A week later, we get Dominic Grieve wins the right to the meaningful vote. And those are the kind of the twin spears upon which Theresa May found herself impaled for the subsequent 18 months. And then it ends with the sort of the fun chaos of the Tory leadership election, with Boris Johnson, you know, running a leadership election, much as he would eventually run his government. With
we'll come to that in a moment. Yeah.
So there's all that stuff, and then book four is obviously Johnson trusts and Sunak premierships, and there's quite a lot to put into that as well.
Absolutely. So I mean, it's this latest volume. It's over, I think it's over 700 pages.
It's 670 pages of text.
Yeah. And then a lot of other notes. I was going to ask actually about this is a technical question, but listeners will be interested. You talked about the Robert Caro approach, the very famous LBJ chronicler, and there are such obvious parallels in the way that you analyse things and the way in which you view your role. But what will you do with all those notes and archive material? Presumably, that sounds like donating something to science, but do you
well, do you feels like I've donated my kidney or something like that already.
But do you I mean, you should, if
look, I have not, I've not said anything, I've not said anything about that, and I certainly haven't done the interviews with people on the basis that I'm going to start handing things out. I think Anthony Seldon, for some of the books he's done, has kind of said one day you will be identified because I'll put everything in the Bodleian Library. I've got no actual plans to do that. But I was at Churchill College, Cambridge, which has the Churchill and the Thatcher archives.
Yep.
So that's a conversation for a future day. I've certainly not got any kind of arrangement. And while I'm a working journalist, I've got no plans to start betraying my contacts by putting stuff out. But maybe there's a case in a couple of decades to bung everything in a library somewhere.
Understood. I mean, on that Caro point, you are firmly in the Caro school in terms of seeking to understand power.
Well, what I don't want people to think is me thinking I'm Robert Caro, because I've read Robert Caro. Robert Caro has written four of the five best books I've ever read about
politics. I disagree.
I know you do.
And I think your books are far more interesting and entertaining. So I'm paying you the compliment.
Well, look, he's a beautiful prose stylist. He puts in the hours. He does the work, I think, as sort of works of literature and explanations of things. But what, you know, he is unsurpassed in my view, and I'm certainly not seeking to compare myself to him. But as a labour of volume, it certainly stands some kind of comparison. And I think what I do take from him, and I'm absolutely clear in the introduction to this book, you know, when I sat down to think about what does all this mean. Because when you've got one damn thing after another and you've got 3 million words of this person said this to this person, you know, what is important? Where do you zoom in and where do you pan back out and try and take a sort of global view? And that's obviously the challenge with a book like this. And you're trying to impose some order on it. I think what I concluded at the end of this whole period was that, you know, politics matters and doing politics well matters. And what does that mean? Mm. And Caro is very good at helping you to think about, you know, what is power? How do you get it? How do you accumulate it? How do you steal it from other people? How do you then mismanage it, abuse it, and then lose it? And that's sort of the story of all of these prime ministers, is a story to one degree or another of that. And I think that's sort of a useful framing device. So that's how I've tried to kind of approach it.
What are the big lessons you've learned about power?
Well, I think the most sort of, it sort of seems banal, but so few politicians actually think about what they're doing and how they're doing it. A lot of them have convictions and want to just do things because that's what they believe. Even those people don't seem to think a great deal about how to go about it. And, you know, the framing device I sort of came up with is that really to be a success, you need to have some kind of strategic goal. Now, that can be shaped by your views or by what you think needs to be done or by a crisis that comes along and presents you with a new problem. And you can devise what those goals are in lots of different ways. You can do what Theresa May or Rishi Sunak or Gordon Brown do and stare at a problem for a long time and read into all the detail and hope that a solution presents itself. Or you can have a very strong ideological view about how things ought to be done. Or like Boris Johnson, you can kind of follow your gut or your balls or whatever it is that governs his behaviour. Probably a bit of both of those things. That then gives you a target. And actually, to be fair to him, you know, if you read a lot of what Alistair Campbell writes about political strategy, about how people win in sport, it's by having a clear goal and an aim and where you're going. Then you need some tactics. And actually, a lot of the time, that comes down to the people you employ, because a lot of politicians don't think about that stuff. But it's the onus is on them to employ people who are kind of good at polling and good at focus groups and good at coming up with messages and good at managing parties and driving things through. And then I think what you need, you know, at least a third of the skill is, can you take people with you? Can you take them from where they are to where you want them to go? And that is partly looking like you've got some conviction, looking like you know what you're doing, but also it's about communicating, it's about empathising. And I think if you look at the track record of the last sort of 4 or 5 prime ministers, you can see that at various points, various of these prime ministers had various of those three attributes. I think arguably Theresa May lacked all three of them at key moments, and that is what ended up costing her. And that's kind of the story of this book.
Yeah.
Book 4, I think there are kind of moments where clearly Boris Johnson in the second half of 2019 had a very clear idea of where he and Dominic Cummings wanted to go, and they had some pretty unpalatable tactics, but they worked because they knew where they were going, and because May had failed and the sort of resistance movement in Parliament had not got itself properly organised, they were able to do that. And that looks like, you know, unpalatable and unpleasant as a lot of it was for some people. I think that was the moment where you can look back and say, this was a plan that was properly pursued. And then, of course, it all fell apart because they had no real plan for what happened afterwards. And the pandemic came along, tore them apart. But the failure of Boris Johnson's premiership ultimately is that, you know, when it came to domestic goals, he was not able to do what he'd done with Brexit and give himself a clear endpoint and a clear means of getting there.
Yeah, I remember I was talking around that time. It may have been around party conference time in 2019. And don't worry, I'm not going to say we was right. Everyone else was wrong, because personally I've been wrong about plenty of things. But it is, I do remember having the conversation with you, that wasn't it remarkable that people couldn't see what Johnson was
yeah,
doing.
I remember that conversation as well, because there weren't many of us around.
No.
I wrote a big read for the Sunday Times. I forget exactly when in August it was, but it was well before Party Commons, sort of mid-August, basically saying this is how they're going to win a general election, and went into... try to basically explain what seemed inexplicable to lots of people. Oh, well, they're going around, they're toying with the Constitution. What are they doing? They're upsetting the Queen. They're doing all this kind of thing. But every time they were opposed by people who wanted to either sort of either block Brexit or sort of send the tributary of Brexit in a different direction, it was reinforcing that argument for them. And it seemed blindingly obvious. And other people who I've got a lot of time for and respect were going around, every time there was some kind of tactical setback, they would say, oh, classic Dom, Cummings has screwed up again, he's done this, he's gone too far, it's upsetting everybody. Well, it was upsetting everybody inside the M25. Yeah. Certainly wasn't upsetting everybody in Doncaster or the Tees Valley or all the other places that were going to vote for the Conservative Party in that general election.
It was also designed deliberately to annoy the people who got annoyed, that they somehow couldn't see that this was deliberate provoking of their opponents, so that they would give him what they'd begun the process sworn not to deliver, which was a general election. I mean, this is what happened to the Lib Dems and to Chuka Umunna and all of that sort of second referendum fever dream.
Totally. But you see it now with Donald Trump still in America. Yeah. Everyone's now used to Trump in America. They've kind of got used to the idea that he's a provocateur and that he'll say things to outrage everybody. But it doesn't stop them going after him and condemning him and taking him to court and doing all the things that, you know, now it may be they're successful in getting him prosecuted, in which case that may have an impact on his poll rating. But if they don't, it's going to have the same effect, I would think, as all that fuss and bother in the autumn of 2019 had here.
Yeah, let's go back to the main focus of this third volume out. Let's talk a bit about Theresa May's premiership. I remember you messaging me on the bus and sort of in the middle of all of that, and I'd finally sort of snapped and had enough and written a piece saying, it was over. And you concurred. I mean, what's the legacy? It's now, I suspect I know the answer here, but sufficient time has passed. A lot of the sort of angst has evaporated, if angst evaporates. But it's the world has moved on. How do you assess her now?
Well, look, I think, I mean, there's quite a shrewd comment was made by one of her close aides, who I think hopes that history will shine a little bit more fondly on her than I think that aide expected me to do, saying with prime ministers, you always feel it where the shoe pinches. And if you've been in a room with her or tried to interview her or had to try to persuade her of something in a meeting, you probably have a dimmer view of her than perhaps a historian in 100 years will, who will see, you know, a hard-working woman who genuinely had a proper passion for public service and who genuinely believed that she ought to deliver not just on the referendum result, but on resolving some of the inequalities and problems that had caused it in the first place. All noble goals. But my argument would be that she didn't really know where she was going when she set off. She worked it out too late. By the time she did work it out, she was then forced to sort of conceal it from her cabinet and the public until it was at the moment to reveal it. And then by the time she finally got around to deciding what it was that she wanted, she'd kind of alienated every group along the way and managed to unite both hardline Brexiteers and the sort of turned Brexisters, who were probably happy to see a soft Brexit in the early days, into people who wouldn't even vote for the Norway option or for a customs union by the end. They just wanted referendum and revoke. And in the end, what she succeeded in doing was making what could have been a sort of quite a nuanced kind of public enterprise into a binary one, where the only real choices were no deal or revoking the thing in the end. And that, I don't think, was a battle that the Brexisters were going to win.
So how did this happen? Is the original sin, in terms of the Tory party's original sin, that she was a Remainer? I don't mean that pejoratively. She voted to remain. She campaigned for remain. Who then, the moment she got into office, had to set about proving her non-existent Brexit credentials.
I think that's right to a large degree.
So you can imagine a Boris Johnson. Now, some listeners will say, stroll on. He would always have made a mess of it. But I can imagine a scenario in which Boris wins the Tory leadership in 2016, doesn't take him out.
Yep.
Boris is then stunned and then makes a speech in which he says it's 52 to 48, it's quite close, and this has to be handled. This has to be handled in a way that brings the country together. It's possible to imagine that. That doesn't mean they're negotiating.
It's totally possible. Look, Boris Johnson takes over in 2016. It's never going to be anything less than chaotic. Boris Johnson clearly did not understand all the implications of that vote. But to be fair to him, once he decided to go a certain way, he did realise he owned it, and he did realise he was responsible for it, and he did realise his legacy would depend on doing it. So whatever he thought before the referendum, I think it's hard to fault the fact that he knew he had to get it done. Had he taken over at that point, look, there would have been, the whole British state didn't really know what this meant. They weren't organised. If you even go back to, you know, the sort of last 100 pages of fallout, it's very clear that the civil service and the cabinet were both on a steep learning curve about all these particular issues. Customs unions, tariffs, non-tariff barriers, which was the one that wasn't really talked about at all during the referendum campaign. In terms of the single market, everyone's focus was on immigration to start with and free movement, but then it pivoted. A lot of people then suddenly became experts about, you know, just-in-time supply systems and all that kind of thing, which, you know, nobody had been talking about beforehand. So Boris Johnson would have had the shock of his life if he'd gone in. And, of course, it took him a long time to fully appreciate what was going on, and not really until he was negotiating his second Brexit deal in the autumn of 2020, which is the thing that became the Trade and Commerce Agreement on Christmas Eve that year. You know, even in September that year, he was still getting tutorials about the customs union from his staff. You know, and again, we're straying into book four, but there's a moment where you know, he turns to David Frost and says, "This is all terrible. I mean,
I shouldn't laugh, but it's therapeutic.
Well, but he's kind of saying, well, this is dreadful. I mean, you know, we've got to get a deal." And Frost says, "That is with a deal. No deal's even worse than the thing that you've just been told about and are now beginning to run." So that would have all happened in the autumn of 2016 instead of the autumn of 2020, I suggest.
And also, would Dominic Cummings, would he have been the chief of staff in Downing Street from the start in 2016? And if he had,
I think he would. Yeah.
If he had been, your point, which I've seen you make before, is that in those circumstances, Cummings was very clear, along with Ivan Rogers, another name from the Brexit wars, that the last thing Britain should do should be to fire Article 50.
Correct.
Before it had a clear view of what the country was seeking to achieve.
Yes. Yeah, so this is there's a systemic problem with Theresa May being a Remain voter. No flies on her. No, you know, that was fine. But structurally, she then had to prove that she was more Brexit than the Brexiteers, and that meant she adopted a more hardline position perhaps she needed to, which then alienated moderate Brexiteers and people who were sort of persuadable that this was democratic to do, but they didn't particularly like it. Then you have the structural problem of going along with the order of proceedings that the EU wanted. And as you say, I mean, the only two people in advance who said to me we shouldn't do this were Cummings and Rogers, who couldn't be coming at this problem from more diametrically opposed ends of the spectrum. But in terms of how to proceed strategically, they both argued that. And had we delayed, and in this book, I quote a senior diplomatic figure, someone who'd been an ambassador who knows the EU very well, who basically said, "You go along." They had imposed this thing, you know, the morning after the referendum, they had this statement, the EU, they put it out saying, "No talks without you notifying," essentially. You know, no declaration, no discussions. And this ambassador, who is very much not a Brexiteer, said to me, "Well, what we should have done at that point is exactly what Rogers and Cummings were suggesting. We say, well, that's great. We're going to go and work out what we want and how it's going to work, and we'll come back to you when we're ready. And if you don't like that, we don't really have to keep paying into this thing, do we? But we've still got a veto, so if we wanted to cause a bit of trouble, we could. And why don't you just back off a bit while we work out what's going on?" And I think, you know, the EU as well strategically made a mistake in not really trying to have a view about any of this strategically, about how you would keep the the British in a sort of outer orbit of the EU, their main priority was to ensure that nobody else left the EU. And the other thing Rogers said to me quite early on, just after he'd resigned at the start of 2017, was we will probably end up going further out to so the EU can show the member states that it really ain't worth doing, and the Brexiteers will be persuaded that we have actually left. And then over a period of 5, 10, 15, 50 years, we'll probably end up in a sort of outer orbit of the EU, whereas David Cameron wanted us in a sort of outer orbit of the EU just inside. We would be somewhere outside. And you look at what Macron's putting forward now, this European political community, sort of concentric circles and all that kind of thing. You can see a quite productive role for Britain with a decent economic relationship, but not encumbered by the political institutions, and playing a sort of, some kind of role in European security. There's a lot of talk about a new deal on that. So things have come a long way. But May's problem was that she didn't think about the strategy or the tactics early on and got herself in a total mess. And she made that speech at Lancaster House, which the Brexiteers loved. To her, that was an opening offer. To them, it was sort of holy writ, and every retreat thereafter from it dwindled her support with the Brexiteers. And I think you're right, if Boris Johnson had turned up and said... The great advantage Boris Johnson had as a leaver and as a sort of the leaver was that if he said it was Brexit, most Leave voters, at least, would accept that. Now, the sort of sovereignty-first guys in the ERG, I think, would always have had a problem with that. But even they recognised when Boris Johnson became Prime Minister that if he said his deal in 2019 was good enough, people would go along with it, and they did. And I think he'd have been able to pull that off in 2016. And don't forget, while he was a pretty unpopular figure in some ways as a result of the referendum then, I don't think it reached the depths that it did sort of 3-4 years later. And at that point, you know, I remember Boris Johnson giving me an interview when he was Foreign Secretary all about reaching out to Remainers. This was in sort of spring of 2018. You can see him making a similar kind of overture, as you say, in the autumn of 2016. And as it would have been a mess. Of course it would. It would have been chaotic. But there are also, interestingly, people in Brussels who would have quite liked that. They would have rather had a stand-up row in 2016, 2017 and resolved it rather than have this sort of endless agonising process where Theresa May sort of consulted everybody. You know, I mean, it's absolutely staggering when you step back that this was the biggest public policy issue facing the British government from the 24th of June 2016, and we didn't have an agreed government policy until the 5th of July 2018. It's two whole years later, and that's, you know, that was part of the problem.
Do you think, I mean, people sometimes blame Cameron and Osborne for that, though Osborne would say that it's Cameron's fault, I assume, but that there was no planning done. I mean, there should surely. I'm not saying it would have resolved all the issues. It might have actually even just, but it might have just flagged some of the problems earlier. There should have been a unit, shouldn't there, somewhere between the cabinet office.
Yeah, I mean, look, I spoke to a very senior person in Brussels about this who said it's the job of every prime minister to say there can't be any planning and it mustn't leak and I mustn't be embarrassed by all the planning, and it's the job of every senior civil servant to do the damn planning. And they didn't. And Jeremy Hayward, you know, who's regarded as a latter-day saint and in many ways was, you know, the most accomplished public servant of his day, he didn't do any of that. And belatedly, you know, Cameron put Oliver Letwin in charge of a cabinet office unit which lasted for about probably 2.5 weeks or something, and then in came Theresa May and got rid of all of that. Though, interestingly, he was already at that stage looking at the numbers and thinking we'll need the Labour Party in some form, or if not the Labour front bench, we should certainly be looking to put some kind of cross-party effort together. And May, you know, again, in part because she was having to impress her own party, didn't want to go down that path.
One of the great things about this huge project that you've undertaken, this Brexit book project, is that you...
I feel like a Theresa May-style public servant, the way you're talking.
But it's is the way in which you are... You're interested in the other side of the negotiation. You're interested in the EU and back to that question of how power is wielded and how people get what they want or persuade others to do what they might have begun not wanting to do. How do you think we sometimes misunderstand, because things, I mean, it was so febrile that period, the media, the public campaigns, the statements made, you know, hysterical statements made by politicians and journalists and commentators included as well. But is there another way to view how the EU handled it? Do you think we got the story wrong?
Yeah, I do think we got the story wrong, actually, and that's one of the sort of partly salutary lessons, but also one of the more interesting aspects of doing this third book. And there's much more EU in this book than there has been in the two previous ones. I made a real effort to go and talk to some of the member states, but also, I mean, the people in the Commission and the Council in Brussels had read a lot of what I'd written and were more than happy to help me kind of get it a bit more right this time round from their perspective, I think. So I got quite a lot of access, particularly during lockdown. We did a lot of Zooms, a couple of flights here and there to see people. So, and I think we saw them as a big amorphous block, the enemy. Now, on the one hand, Theresa May and David Davis, her first Brexit secretary, were, they felt that you could break them down. Their big goal was to go and play sort of divide and rule with the member states. I mean, the path to Brexit is littered with the corpses of British prime ministers who thought Angela Merkel was going to save the day. And, you know, really at no point did she do that for Cameron or for May or for anybody else. But while we were playing, we thought there might be divisions between the member states. I mean, I remember David Davis saying to me, you know, he was doing up this grid for the end game and he was going to go and work out, well, would the deal need to pass in the, you know, the sub-regional part of the Belgian parliament? And if so, who were the parties there that might assist us and could we bung them more fish to do this? And that was, on one level, a kind of sophisticated way of looking at it. On another, it was completely nonsensical because they held the line as a block of member states far better than anybody expected. And if Michel Barnier has a signal achievement, I think it's that they kind of, you know, they negotiated as one block and we negotiated as if we were 27 different countries. But we also didn't appreciate that there was a difference between the European Council and the European Commission. May's deal was seen as a bit of a hodgepodge by the council, the people around Donald Tusk. Now, Tusk was a kind of emotional kind of anti-Brexiteer. He was quite happy to try and help the resistance in London. But the very sensible and senior officials around him just thought this half-in, half-out thing doesn't work. We'd have rather had a kind of clean fight about it. The real people who actually helped were the people who were regarded in the lowest possible esteem by
people like Martin Selmer.
Well, Juncker was regarded as this sort of rather bovine idiot who drinks too much. And, you know, I remember being briefed about him having brandy for breakfast and all that kind of thing. And it was all great fun. And Selmer was a kind of comedy villain, you know, twirling his moustache, Juncker's right-hand man, known as the monster of the Berlaymont and all that kind of thing. But actually, the story I got from some of these trips to Brussels and elsewhere and some of the conversations I had with people in London were that actually when things got to the real crunch moments, it was the Commission that helped out. Juncker wanted a deal. He didn't want to, you know, have Brexit on his watch and then a no deal to finish off his period as president. And Selmer is a kind of, he's a deal maker. He gets an almost, you know, I mean, it will be reasonably obvious. I've spoken to him when you read the book. So I say I've looked him in the eye. This is a guy who gets a proper, almost sexual frisson from doing a deal. You know, he just loves it. And what was happening, while all the focus was on Barnier, this sort of, you know, Frenchman in his expensively cut suits with his pocket square sort of twirling around and making David Davis look a bit silly, the real action, even in the room, was, of course, done by his deputies, who were Sabine Weyand and Stephanie Riso. But the real action was done on the top of hotels in secret meetings between Oliver Robbins and Martin Selmer. They would go and have dinner in Brussels, miles away from where the press pack was likely to be. And they'd spend 2 hours talking about their kids and basically having a therapy session. And then they'd say, right, how do we resolve this? And at the end of it, they'd kind of swap wording back and forth on napkins. And then Selmer might call Weyand and say, this is what we're thinking. And she'd kind of swallow it if she was told to. And they basically overruled Barnier. And the same thing happened under Boris Johnson when David Frost was his chief negotiator. By then, Riso had moved to be the key person working for Ursula von der Leyen, so she was kind of the new Selmer. And von der Leyen again got sick of the sort of impasse between Frost and Barnier. And, you know, Riso and Frost were smuggled in and out of each other's offices, up and down in lifts where Barnier couldn't see them. They were literally deploying you know, you'd send an attractive young female civil servant into the corridor to intercept Barnier and talk to him about, you know, his heroic exploits in some fashion, while Rousseau was being, you know, smuggled out of the negotiating room because they'd come up with some deal. And Barnier's memoirs are hilarious. He's written this book, you know, My Brexit Diaries, which my sources in Brussels tell me were fairly heavily edited by the people in Brussels because it would have been sort of a bit too embarrassing to have it all in there. But he is constantly, well, I say constantly, it's three or four moments if you know what you're looking for, he's sort of moaning about, oh, well, Zelmar's getting involved again, or the Brits keep thinking they've gone behind my back, but they haven't. And it's like, well, they did actually, mate. And they did it twice, yeah. Quite successfully, actually. Yeah. And that's the other interesting thing. In this sort of litany of failure, and lots of people don't like the deal David Frost did either. Most people moan about, you know, the people on the Brexit side moan about the Robbins deal. The Robbins deal was a brilliant piece of negotiation if what you wanted was exactly what Theresa May wanted. As a sort of functional exercise, it was good. And Frost ended up getting broadly what Frost and Johnson wanted, which was a much more pure sovereignty, we don't want the connections kind of deal. Now, lots of people will stand back and bemoan that. And I love Anthony Seldon dearly, who's a sort of one of my mentors. But in his book, he sort of says, they got the wrong sort of Brexit. Well, I'm not judging that. I'm trying to judge whether they got what they wanted. Were they successful in their own terms? And, you know, to a degree, both of them were. But the problem for May and Robbins was that they just didn't operate in a world that was reality that was happening back in London.
Because this is, yeah, I was just going to say, meanwhile, back in London, while all this is happening, talking about the May era as distinct from the Frost Johnson era, while all this is happening, politics is going completely mad.
Yeah. So, frankly, people say, oh, you can't use that word anymore. You can't talk about people being... People went mad.
Yes.
People were literally depressed. They had anxiety.
Yep.
People had breakdowns as a result of this. People, MPs were living on the edge. They felt this was the most important thing that they were ever going to have to deal with. The passions on both sides were off the charts. This is the only period in my working life when I can remember sort of having genuine contempt for some of the people I was on the phone to, and they hated my guts. I mean, and people who were good contacts, who we'd always dealt with reasonably, you'd have sort of shouting matches about what they were doing and why they were doing it and how they were doing it. And it was tense. And then, you know, you throw COVID onto the end of that.
Yeah.
And it's no wonder this has been a sort of existentially weird kind of strung out moment in British politics that has really kind of wrecked a lot of people's lives.
Yes, it has. I mean, I remember the I'm sure you were there, the night sitting in the press gallery, the night of the... Well, there were lots and lots of votes, but the meaningful votes thing,
yeah,
where it just became apparent that parliament was bust, that they wouldn't vote for anything.
Yeah.
And there was sort of vote after vote, and it just, I remember putting my head in my hands and just, I mean, it was...
Two occasions where we had MPs got to vote a sort of multiple choice vote. One was eight options and the other was four. And I think six of the eight and three of the four were versions of soft Brexit. You could have found a majority for something, and people would not vote for their second favourite thing. They had to have what they wanted, and they thought the other lot were going to demand it, and so they had to demand it. And it became, you know, the speech Geoffrey Cox made where he kind of basically said, you were busted flush, the lot of you, you shouldn't be here anymore. I mean, it was not the most elegant speech ever made in the House of Commons, but for people on his side, it was a sort of cathartic roar about what was going on. And at the start of this book, I thought, oh, well, you know, what is politics? And I was thinking about Caro, thinking about, you know, around this issue. And the ultimate political quote is the Bismarck one about politics is the art of the possible. And it seemed during this process that, you know, too many people were pursuing the impossible a lot of the time. And I thought, well, if I'm going to put this at the start of my book, I'd better go and check out what the full quote is. And there's much more.
There's
a second line, and almost no one knows the second line. So the full quote is, politics is the art of the possible, the attainable, the art of the second best. And my God, did MPs and everybody around them forget that. And if they'd remembered it, we probably would have a much softer Brexit deal, or we'd have had much more pragmatism earlier on. And, you know, where we are, I mean, in a sense, you know, you can look for the reasons why everything happened. What these books are trying to do is just say, this is why we ended up where we did, as a result of this accretion of decisions. And too often it was a bunch of decisions without much forethought. And as a result of that, options got closed off, you know, perfectly viable paths were ignored. And by the end of it, everybody was saying, oh, Brexit's impossible, we can't do it, it's too contradictory, it's ridiculous. Well, it was nonsense. It's a political problem to be solved. And, you know, the same went for all those tricky issues in Northern Ireland. We'd always managed to get by with a political fudge there before, and we're back to doing that now. But for this period, it seemed impossible because everybody had, you know, they weren't just wearing their hearts on their sleeves. They were screaming from the rooftops as well.
It's because it was a radicalising process, wasn't it? It was, I was a Brexiteer, still am. I'm glad that we left the EU, but I can understand why people are upset about it. But I'd term myself, as having started the process, as a moderate Brexiteer, and I just assumed, wrongly, that there would end up with some kind of compromise solution, some sort of softer Brexit. And the process started to play out, and it happened like water dripping on stone. After a couple of years, before you know where you are, you know, you start with the gateway drug, and then in my case, you're writing pieces advocating no deal on the basis that
But you were also in despair, if I remember rightly.
I was in despair.
You were very frustrated by the process when you were writing those columns.
Yes, okay. And the reason I arrived at the no deal position, which I didn't want to happen, but I was one of those Brexiteers, moderate Brexiteers, who got to the point with the People's Vote crowd where I just thought, right, if that's the choice, if it is not respecting implementing the referendum, I remember saying on stage at an FT festival thing with Alistair Campbell, in front of, I can't speak for everyone in the audience, but let's say it was a Remain crowd.
It seems likely that it
was. It was, yeah. And I was the sacrificial Brexiteer. And I said, well, you know, we're not going to, you think we're just going to sort of take this?
Yeah.
I mean, let's make it best of three. I mean, and who did we learn this lesson from, that you don't accept democratic results? We learnt it from the Remain campaign. So over the course of that period, quite a few of us who were moderate Brexiteers got ourselves into a position we hadn't intended to at all. And I think the same as friends of mine, lots of people fell out, but friends of mine who were on the Remain side, who began by accepting the result, sometimes ended up on marches or felt that the thing was such a mess and that no planning had been done, and actually the only option that had been sold on the basis of lies, which always makes me laugh. I mean, both sides lied their socks off. I mean, that's the sort of point of that terrible, crazy populist campaign. But I wonder if it was so...
But some people can only see the lies on the one side.
Precisely. You know. But it was so... I mean, I remember saying the 350 million... figure was a mistake and was wrong and should be corrected by Dominic Cummings, as you know, you can sit here as sort of hollow laugh now, but I wonder if it was such a radicalizing, traumatic political event, for the quite obvious reason that it's about something really fundamental. I know that compromise should have been involved, but it was one of the most complicated and philosophically interesting things which the British state has attempted to do since the Second World War.
I think that's right.
It was always going to be difficult.
Yeah, no, it was. And there's a quote in book three from one of the very senior civil servants in London, who kind of, obviously not a Brexiteer themselves, but kind of said, look, this is fascinating. When do you get a problem? When do you get a situation like this, when we literally have to decide who are we as a country? What are we about? What do we want to go and do? And in a sense, what could have been an interesting sort of discussion about all of that turned into, I want this or I want that. And I think, you know, what you were saying before, I think is right. I think what this gives us an insight into is kind of revolutionary moments that you see in history. You know, if you can't understand the French Revolution, everyone cutting off everybody's heads, or you can't understand the English Civil War, the American Civil War, where brother is shooting brother, we didn't get that far. And you know, remembering Joe Cox and that's a horrendous thing, and it's not sort of, it's only semi-true to say that, you know, no blood was shed, though the links to the referendum are more peripheral than sort of exact. But you know, you can see how I think I had an insight into seeing how this stuff happens in a way that it seems very distant and historic. And why did everybody go so crazy and use the guillotine and do all that? 200 years earlier, people would have been chopping each other's heads off as a result of this stuff. That was the level of passion and the level of... But I think you're right. I mean, what I desperately try to do is kind of explain why the people on each side were trying to do what they were trying to do and explain where they'd come from and what their journey was to that point of view. And as far as I'm concerned, all of those positions are kind of equally valid. I have my own, and there was a sort of logic to it. I voted for Remain, but I felt that... What I could never get a straight answer out of the resistance crew about was, what is the good outcome here of you winning a referendum, of holding and winning another referendum? What is the good news there? Why do you think that would then settle the issue? Because it seemed obvious to me, A, that it wouldn't settle it, but B, that they would get their backsides handed to them. You know, a combination of Cummings and Farage saying, tell these bastards again.
Yes.
I'd been gobsmacked if it had been less than 60% for Leave at that point. And they just couldn't see that outside SW1. Yeah. And I've spoken to, I've asked that question of dozens of people, all of whom I respect, and I think they're genuinely decent, you know, people who are very quite thoughtful about what they do. You know, people like Nick Bowles and people like, I mean, actually, he didn't want a referendum, but people like Dominic Grieve, people like Steve Doughty in the Labour ranks. You know, you talk to these people who are involved in Change UK, and you ask them that, and they sort of say, well, you know, it was good to do it for this reason, and, you know, people might have changed them. And it's just this, but there was never really a kind of clear how this is going to pan out. And you say, well, might there be violence? Oh, well, you know, that would be a terrible thing, and it's, you know, that would be on the people doing it. And it's like, you're not sort of wholly divorced from responsibility for that if you're the ones doing this. And I could never quite... I would have been persuaded if I'd been persuaded, but I wasn't by what I heard.
Another complication, of course, is that you put it very well there in terms of revolutions, and you can see how the English Civil War and the related, you know, civil wars. And
don't forget, the English Civil War was similar to that. It was all about, where do you put the altar in a church and things like that.
Yes.
You know, sort of theological points.
Even more so in terms of Scotland and the Civil War and, other parts of the...
And this is why, you know, I would love a brilliant TV series on the English Civil War, but people say it won't work because you can't empathise with that. It just seems mad. And in 200 years, people are going to look back at some of this and think this seems a bit mad as well.
Yeah. Or alternatively, I mean, I'm always persuaded by the idea that the English Civil War, or the civil wars in these islands, are ongoing and never really settled because of what springs out of them.
Out of it comes
a Whig tradition, and out of it comes tourism. But I wonder if it was part of the complication with Brexit is that the very institution that we look to protect us from that wildness that you described is Parliament.
Yes.
Parliament is
just
a court.
The mediating thing.
It's exactly. Parliament is best understood as many things, but it is at root, it's a court, right?
So, yeah, it's where you go and have a war without fighting.
Exactly.
Essentially,
it's how you settle,
how you settle disputes.
Exactly, you settle
and
disputes.
And Parliament was unable to settle those disputes.
Yes,
so in part because of the Fixed Term Parliament Act, and you couldn't have a Prime Minister who wanted to, you know, threaten people with an election and drive them into line. There's a sort of one of the interesting tributaries that went dry was a plan in mid 2018 to make a second meaningful vote into a vote of no confidence under the Fixed Term Parliament Act. So they would have effectively amended the law, and the idea was that you'd have had a first vote and everybody could have vented their feelings. So people who really didn't like this could vote against it. But when it came to the crunch of, does this government rise or fall, you would have been able to sort of determine that with it. And essentially what happened was Parliament lost any confidence in the May government, but May had no means of turning that into a general election and making a stand and making people agree or disagree with her in the country. We were left with this sort of melange in Parliament that just would not resolve itself.
So book three is out now.
That's right. And
then book four is coming. It's in the works. It's due to be released in June, so people can...
That's right. I'm nearly done with it. There's a full draft. I'm just feeding in extra transcripts and taking account of a few other things that have been written.
Yeah.
a quick glance at Liz Truss's book, you know.
Okay, let me know how you get on with
But again, it's a thick, weighty tome, I'm afraid. But yeah, so the you've got the drama of that second half of 2016 with Johnson driving it through. You've got the election campaign. You've then got the sort of long march to a Brexit deal in 2020 with COVID intervening. Then you've got the pivot from that deal into a sort of, do we break the law and do all that sort of stuff? And then Sunak eventually coming in and doing the Windsor deal and then the sort of update that happened. But along the way, you know, people will expect me to cover the general sort of cut and thrust of politics. So, yeah, you know, there's a good few fun three chapters on trusts and, you know, and at the moment, I mean, I've got about 2 weeks to go before I finish this off. You know, the ending could still get change. At the moment, the final chapter is, oh, look, David Cameron's back in the government. Immigration's back at the top of the list of public concerns. And, oh, look, there's another Tory leadership plot.
Exactly.
Plus ça change.
Yeah, and you were talking earlier about politics being done well. I mean, that is the, regardless of what Liz Truss believes in or not, that's the main charge against her. It's just politics really badly done.
Really
If you want to reform the OBR, do what Margaret Thatcher would have done, which is then the next time an appointment comes up, put in a key person, reshuffle it, then maybe look for some key appointments at the Bank of England, think about how you can change the culture. You know, Margaret Thatcher didn't scrap exchange controls, capital controls, probably the key reform of her entire 11 years in office. She had to be persuaded of it, and she did it 6 months in with a lot of very careful planning by the Bank of England, the Treasury, and Nigel Lawson.
Well, and also, you go and talk to all these latter-day Thatcherites in the Conservative Party who don't necessarily all have a firm grasp of the history, and you say, what do you think the top rate of income tax was in 1986? And they're just staggered to discover it was 60%.
Yes, exactly.
It was only then, 7 years in, that they had the nerve under Lawson to kind of cut it properly.
Yeah. So we'll talk again when and if you're game for coming back.
Very much so.
When the next book comes out, we can talk about Boris and all of that and what it means. Just on a couple of quick questions to finish. On Brexit, sounds glib, but How do you assess it now? Is it working? I mean, you know my view that on foreign affairs and defence, I think, and the way that defence technology is going to develop, I think not being regulated by the EU, but being key in the European pillar of NATO and part of a broader set of alliances and AUKUS is central. I think the way the world is developing, I think it's a positive thing.
I'm afraid you will find me in violent agreement on that. I think the one completely unalloyed success is the freedom on foreign policy and the fact that we've been able to plough our own furrow at a time when quite a lot of scary stuff's going on. And, you know, what John Bew, who has worked for the last four prime ministers, got right in number 10 when he was doing his sort of strategic defence review was to work out that what we need in this day and age is not a series of sort of fixed alliances, but an ability to be sort of quick, nimble, find like-minded countries on particular problems. You know, we had, I think, a deal with the Canadians and I think, was it the Dutch on the Hong Kong people? When it came to Ukraine, Johnson went off with the Joint Expeditionary Force, the JEF, which is, the Baltics, the Scandinavians.
Absolutely. Key alliance.
Key alliance. You know, we've formed AUKUS. That will probably expand. You know, all this stuff, you know, people say, oh, well, we've damaged our international reputation. I think we've got more international clout now than we've had for quite some time because we're proactive in these battles. And, you know, we've been able to lead the way on Western support for Ukraine, which I think wouldn't have been impossible, but it would have been quite awkward doing that within the EU. On the rest of it, I mean, the economics, people are going to have their models and they're going to argue over it. Some people say it's cost us 5% of GDP. Other people say it's probably nearer 1%. What price do you put on sovereignty? That's very difficult. I never felt we were sort of natural members of the political institutions. And, you know, there's a sort of British exceptionalism, which some people on the left don't like about that. But, you know, it's something that a lot of people in this country feel. I think the proof will be in the future rather than in the slightly turbulent past where, you know, undoubtedly COVID and, you know, the sort of oil shock around the war have played their role as well. I've asked a lot of serious economists, you know, in person and on Twitter and places like that, you know, how do you break down the problems we've got now as a percentage, you know, what's fallout from the 2008 crash? What's fallout from COVID? What's, you know, and nobody can really put numbers on this. The proof will be, can we take advantage of some of the freedoms for AI, for electric vehicles, for, as you say, defence technology, you know, at a time when the world's fighting itself quite a lot, then there's going to be, you know, growth money to be had in that as well, unpalatable as that will be for some people. But, you know, Britain, if it's nimble and clever, can do well out of this. And I think on foreign policy it has. I've not yet seen that, I think, domestically or in quite enough in terms of foreign investment coming here and all that kind of thing. Yeah. And I think, you know, if Starmer is clever, if he gets in, he will, you know, work with business and try and do more of that. And ironically, he might end up making more of a success of Brexit than the Brexiteers have.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, final question, how do you think he'll handle the process? He's obviously going to be received well in Brussels, yeah. And there'll be a whole, if he wins the election, which seems likely, there'll be a whole series of photo opportunities, and there'll be probably a defence and security pact of some sort.
It looks very likely, doesn't it?
But yeah. But do you think, I mean, because you've chronicled that, you've explained to people, to your readers, how it's sometimes not quite what it appears, the Commission, the Council. There's a scenario in which Labour has 6 months of lots of warm words,
yeah.
But actually, really,
will it go anywhere?
Can you change the deal very much, do you think?
Well, look, the TCA, which is Johnson's trade deal, comes up for review in 2025. My understanding is that there's not a huge appetite in Brussels to change that in any kind of radical way. And behind the scenes in Whitehall, basically since Sunak got in, civil servants here and the Commission over there have been quietly working to try and iron out a lot of the problems. And you saw that, you know, they did the Windsor deal, they then did the follow-up to try and get the DUP back into the power-sharing agreement. That was a bit of window dressing, I think, to, you know, iron out some of the problems. And in terms of the practicalities, they're working through them already, and that work will continue whoever the Prime Minister is. So it may be that Starmer wants to make more of that and say, well, we've ironed out this problem or this problem or this problem. At the moment, I think both sides are quite happy for that to happen under the radar. Now that Boris Johnson's no longer screaming about EU concessions on this or they're telling, you know, announcing that he's climbed down on that, then you can do these things and have slightly less friction. And I think that's going on anyway. But will these warm words lead to anything fundamental? They're still deal makers. And, you know, we've already seen what their offer in return is. And that is that they are very keen to see a youth mobility agreement, which will be sort of effectively sort of freedom of movement for certain age groups, which will, you know, is something Starmer will have to approach, having rolled the pitch pretty carefully, I would suggest, and he hasn't remotely done that yet. But that certainly is going to be their big ask. And in fact, if you talk to people in the Commission about the David Frost negotiation, they were very surprised that we weren't prepared to do more on sort of sectoral mobility things. I mean, everybody got very upset about bands not being able to tour and all that sort of thing. They thought that was all a bit silly. But Frost wanted a sort of pure sovereignty deal just for the sake of it, you know, to prove that that could be done and that they'd back down on it. But that then lessened our ability to get some other things in that same sort of bucket of the negotiations. So that's what they'll come with. That's what they want to see. I think there is a mutual interest in doing some kind of defence deal. I don't think that will be held up by discussions about anything else. But I think if Starmer thinks he can turn up and tinker a bit just because he's a nice bloke and they like him and he's not a Tory, I think he might discover that a lot of the tinkering's been done already, actually, and if you're going to do anything, you probably do need to do something a little bit more fundamental. And if he's going to do that, he's going to have to be very careful to sort of prime the public for it, because right now they're not remotely primed for anything like that. And, you know, that could be a recipe for leeching more votes in certain parts of the country, I suspect. And he's, I think, pretty wary of that. And I met recently with some senior Labour people to talk about some of sort of foreign policy issues, and they're very keen to talk about the Middle East, very keen to talk about what they do in America. Didn't want to talk about what's going to go on with the EU, and there's probably a good reason for that.
Funny
because
that.
Either they haven't worked it out, or B, they have, and they don't really want to tell anybody.
Yeah, it could easily turn into very good, here, have a croissant. Oh, that sounds very interesting. No.
Yeah.
So
they will discover that just being nice and being their sort of person does not get you necessarily what you want. You know, Ollie Robbins got a lot of that. They loved Ollie Robbins. They thought David Frost was terribly rude. They didn't like him at all. But both of them ended up getting, you know, sort of a version of what they wanted. But just turning up and being communautaire is not enough to get you past, you know, single market rules and some of their red lines. It's wrong to say they didn't cave in on things. They did change their red lines for us repeatedly. But there are some that, you know, are pretty fundamental.
It's politics, it's power. Tim Shipman, thank you for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.
So we've been talking to Tim Shipman about his public service Brexit project, the third volume, must read, of his Brexit quartet, No Way Out From the Backstop to Boris, is out now with the fourth volume. Look out for it coming out in June, and Tim and I will talk again then. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, you go to the website www.reaction.life. You get my weekly newsletter on politics, geopolitics, defence and all sorts of other things. Until next time, thank you for listening.